Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We realize working with a coalition of several groups around the world, we have realized that people who are have not been properly recognized and do not seek and get the justice they deserve. So we have successfully placed on the UN agenda.
President Julius Maada Bio says the Sierra Leonean government respects the rule of law and protects the fundamental rights of citizens.
During this period, we'll have both audit and maybe we'll have everything related to the election. So after the last election, we hope at the end of next year, we'll have a democratic government in the country. This is our wishes.
A key opposition figure in Guinea welcomes as a step in the right direction calls by the new transitional president, Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, for an audit of all public accounts.
The Minister of State for Internal Affairs, General David Muhoozi, has to offer an apology in Parliament. He was compelled to actually apologize even when opposition was in boycott. We are not in the House when he was compelled to apologize.
And lawmakers from the minority in the Ugandan Parliament say their boycott of parliamentary proceedings will continue until further notice. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio says the country is changing to a West African nation that respects the rule of law and protects the fundamental rights of citizens as enshrined in the Constitution. Mr. Maada Bio, who is currently holding a series of meetings with top U.S. officials and business leaders, says the negative narrative about his country is changing for the better. He says that's due to his administration's policies, including transparency and accountability, that are encouraging to the country's development partners. In part two of our interview, President Julius Maada Bio spoke about the inclusive development of his country and about creating an enabling environment for private business and foreign investors.
Do you think Sierra Leoneans feel part of this inclusive development? Because some people have said that it appears that certain parts of the country that voted for you are being developed to the contrary to others that did not necessarily support you. So would you say that all Sierra Leoneans feel part of this inclusive development that you have been talking about?
The biggest development we have today is free quality education for every child in Sierra Leone, not for any region. Be you from the north, the south, the east, and the west, the resources we have provided is for every child. That is inclusive. For me, that is in fact the most important thing. So the same opportunity my daughter has to go to school is the same opportunity you have in every part of the country, even if you cannot afford it, the government is. So at the time I took over, I come from the south, and the south and the southeast are normally blended together. In most part of the north, every district headquarter can be reached on a paved road. And in most part of the south and the east, most district headquarters cannot be reached on a paved road. So what do we do? If we are talking about inclusion, you make sure that every district headquarter can be reached on a paved road. The district where I come from has no paved road, not even a meter of paved road. I have to fix that. Not because I come from there, because it's a national policy to make sure that you can reach every district headquarter on a paved road. It would be very unwise of me to leave areas that have not been attended to, unserved, and go and maybe repave other roads when these ones are still yet to be paved.
Mr. President, since you've been here, I know you've been talking to businesses to come and invest in Sierra Leone, but has your government created the enabling environment to allow the local business people or the ordinary Sierra Leonean to invest in Sierra Leone? And do you think, by extension, that could allow foreigners or foreign direct investment to flow into Sierra Leone to invest, to create the jobs for the youth that the country needs.
We need a lot of jobs, and the government can definitely not provide enough jobs to meet with the demand for jobs. The business climate is what we have been working on. It's our business to create an ecosystem that makes it possible for the private sector to thrive, and when they thrive, then they can actually go out and get the employment for the youths. We have done quite a lot of reforms to make the ease of business, doing business in Sierra Leone better. We have also reduced the burden of allowing foreign businesses in particular who go in and have to go through some middlemen who create a lot of problems for them. Now we have the National Investment Board, which I chair, co-chaired by the Vice President, where we look at all investment proposals, and once we find them worthy, we make sure that they are served right down the chain, and we continue to monitor them to make sure that they do not encounter other challenges down the line. But really, it's like midwifing these businesses so that they can get settled without being scammed by anybody, which has been the situation before.
Mr. President, I understand Sierra Leone for the first time presented a resolution at the UN to help the girl child, to protect the girl child, not only in Sierra Leone, but on the world stage. Talk to me about this resolution.
As I stated earlier, our commitment to make sure that the women are part of our development process and are treated as equals is a commitment that I have stood by before election, and I still stand by it. And we have taken measures at home. I told you about the rape issues and how we are trying to address that. I told you about the empowerment and equity policy, and how my wife is also out in the country for the most part trying to stop early marriage, teen pregnancy, and all the issues associated with protecting the girl child. How we have set up special courts, one-stop centers to address rape issues. We have taken it to the international stage. We realize, working with a coalition of several groups around the world, we have realized that people who are raped have not been properly recognized and do not seek and get the justice they deserve. So we have successfully placed on the UN agenda.
Julius Maada Bio is the Sierra Leonean president. He spoke with me from here in Washington. In Guinea, a prominent opposition figure has welcomed as a step in the right direction calls by the new transitional president, Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, for an audit of all public accounts. Sidya Touré, leader of the opposition Republican Forces, says a thorough investigation into public accounts will determine the country's financial health. His remarks come after Colonel Doumbouya, the leader of the military junta, was officially installed as president. Opposition and civil society groups had routinely accused public officials in former President Alpha Condé's government of engaging in corruption, allegations they deny. Meanwhile, some of the groups warn that the audit should be transparent to ensure it doesn't appear to be a witch hunt targeting members of the former administration. Opposition figure Sidya Touré tells me that the audit could also determine public officials who have engaged in acts of financial malfeasance.
This is, I think, the main important problem we have in Guinea, is the level of the corruption during the Alpha Condé's period. Since Alpha was elected in 2010 to today, you just can't imagine that government never bring, I don't know, one hospital or one university or 100 kilometers of the road. All the money from bauxite and all was absolutely, corrupted and was absolutely stolen. you know, it's very important for this government to know what happened during this period and level of the corruption in Guinea. It's the main purpose of this thing. People are saying it's for the third mandate. Yes, third mandate was very complex. But the main thing was corruption, because what brings a poverty, you know, in this country at the level we never seen since the independence.
But Mr. Touré, some people are suggesting that allegations of corruption against President Condé and members of his government are just mere allegations. There is no proof or evidence of that. How do you respond to that?
It's very simple. This is why we need an audit about that, you know. But it's very simple. I'm telling you something you didn't understand very well. I said, during this 10 years period, you cannot show me an university that the government has built. We are now exporting more than 680 million tons of bauxite. And this money is not in the budget.
The constitution has been suspended. What punishment could be meted out to those found responsible to have embezzled public funds?
I say, you know, we can do that, and maybe the next government will continue the job, but we have to do it now, you know. We have to begin the audit now. It'd be something very fair. This audit can bring us, you know, the reality of the situation, the financial situation of Guinea.
Mr. Touré, as a leading opposition figure, what is your anticipation about how long this transitional process should last before elections are organized?
We political parties, you know, we have a memo we bring to them, and we ask that, you know, the most important thing to do is to have a brief transition, not very long. So we imagine at the end of next year, things can be really done in the better condition for the old demand to have a real government after election, you know. And we think that it can be done at this time.
ECOWAS proposed a 6 months transitional period. The military junta is saying that it is only Guineans who can determine the period of the transition. So how do you reconcile these two?
We have our own suggestion, but this is why we need somebody to be designated by ECOWAS, maybe a former president of I don't know what country. I can hear. So during this discussion, we have to help. We will have a decision, I think. I'm sure this is what can be done. What can be done, absolutely.
As opposition parties in Guinea, what is your reaction following the official swearing-in of President Colonel Doumbouya to lead the transitional period, although the period is yet to be determined before the elections?
You know, that was a coup. And, you know, we was make a rally in streets during 2 years. We have around 200 people were shot and died. People of Guinea tried to show to Alpha Condé that he cannot go like he was doing the things. And if those people didn't come, we have a real bad situation in the country. So we support this coup d'etat. That's absolutely, we don't have to say so because we are Democrats, but we didn't have any other solution. From what during this period, it's totally normal to have a president of transition. This is what we used to do anyway. During this period, we'll have the audit, and maybe we'll have everything related to the election. So after the last election, we hope at the end of next year, we'll have a democratic government in the country. This is our wishes.
Sidi Touré is the leader of the opposition Republican Forces. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. Lawmakers from the minority in the Ugandan parliament say they are undeterred in their decision to boycott parliamentary proceedings until further notice. The move, the parliamentarians say, is to pressure the administration in Kampala to respect the rule of law. It comes after two opposition party members from the National Unity Platform, or NUP, were granted bail but subsequently arrested by state security agents. Legislators Alan Sewanyawa and Mohamed Segrinya face murder and terrorism charges. They deny any wrongdoing. The minority in parliament say they will not return to the legislature until their colleagues are allowed to go through the normal legal process without any political interference. But critics say the boycott appears to be a publicity stunt to influence the legal proceedings and to make the government unpopular. They argue that the lawmakers face serious charges and should focus their energies on a good legal defense in the much-anticipated trial. John Baptiste Nambishi, Minority Chief Whip in Parliament, says the decision to boycott the body was unanimous among all opposition lawmakers. He tells me that they will continue to boycott plenary sittings of Parliament until due process is followed in the prosecution of their colleagues and other arrested opposition supporters.
So the decision to boycott Parliament has already been made. We declared a boycott on Wednesday after exhausting all avenues of seeking redress. And it's not only that it is we are doing this because of the two colleagues who have been incarcerated, but right from the time a number of citizens, particularly supporters of National Unity Platform, that have all mysteriously disappeared, a number of them have been taken to places which are not even authorized by law.
But do you think the boycott of Parliament will have any significance? Because the National Resistance Movement enjoys overwhelming majority in Parliament anyway. So what will the boycott of Parliament do for you?
Boycott of Parliament has already yielded results positively. As you may recall, on the very day we raised this matter as a matter of urgent public importance on the floor of Parliament, which was Tuesday, the Speaker suspended Parliament. And few though we are, it is not about tyranny of numbers. It is tyranny of reason and logic, and it has worked. After suspension of Parliament, eventually the Speaker, after we had walked out in protest, the Speaker, even when he remained with the so-called numbers of NRM, had to adjourn the House because he realized any engagement, any deliberations or debate had degenerated into a monologue, government still talking to itself. Those were first signs of successful pressure. And further, we have still, with our few numbers, we have compelled the House into recess.
The charges your colleagues face are quite serious, and some people are suggesting that the legal process should be allowed to proceed without any political interference. And what the opposition is doing is politically interfering in the judicial process. How do you respond to that?
It is government that is committing political interference in the due process that had commenced. Because if the allegation is anything to go by, under normal procedure, the summons had commenced through normal process by going through the Speaker of Parliament, which was okay. But eventually, government degenerated when they kidnapped, you can't call it a rearresting, because after a court had granted the suspects bail, the government security forces descended on them brutally and violently. The violence and brutality that has been visited upon the members have culminated into serious ailments, because the Honorable Segrinya has abdominal complications. The Honorable Sewanyana has pains all over the body. So now, of the two, who has committed political interference? Government.
But realistically, do you think, Mr. Nambisha, that your intended boycott will force the government to respect the rule of law, as you have said?
Whether the government yields to the pressure that we are mounting, whether the government sees reason in all the issues that we are raising, and actually, even as we also seek further redress in courts of judicature against government, it will go on record, because the role of opposition is to keep government in check. Ours is for checks and balances. So far, so good. Because in keeping government in check, they have to account. And already, the Minister of State for Internal Affairs, General David Muhoozi,
has to offer an apology in parliament. He was compelled to actually apologize even when opposition was in boycott. We are not in the house when he was compelled to apologize.
John Baptist Nambishe is the minority chief whip in parliament. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The president of the African Development Bank, Dr. Akinwumi Adesina, has been holding a series of meetings with top U.S. government officials and business leaders. The move, he says, forms part of the bank's effort to attract increased U.S. investment in Africa. In part two of my interview, Dr. Akinwumi Adesina spoke about President Joe Biden's Africa agenda, Chinese business and investment activity in Africa, and Africa's position ahead of November's Global Climate Conference, COP26, in Glasgow, Scotland. He also underscored the importance of renewable energy, climate resilience, adaptation and mitigation, and emerging technology.
I really love and commend President Biden's administration because first, with regard to re-engaging America in global multilateralism. It's very, very important. Two major decisions that were made. First is to make sure that with regard to issue of vaccines and access to medication and support for the World Health Organization, the President Biden is also taking a big leadership position with regard to the issue of climate. You know, Africa is disproportionately affected by climate because of our vulnerability. You know, we lose $7 to $15 billion a year as a result of climate shocks. I had a real fantastic discussion with Secretary Kerry, President Biden's special envoy on climate, just before coming to Washington. And we agreed that it's very important to mobilize more resources. The African Development Bank is going to be a very critical partner with the U.S. government in mobilizing climate financing for Africa. Already, we have doubled our climate financing on the continent to $25 billion by 2025. But most importantly is what that really composes of. We've actually increased the share of our climate financing going to adaptation, because adaptation is really where the issue is for Africa. I feel a sense of optimism. I feel a sense of commitment. I feel a sense of changing the narrative on Africa in terms of, well, look, don't look at Africa in terms of aid. Look at Africa in terms of, you know, significant investment destination that we should be looking at with a different lens.
Talking about the climate, Dr. Adesina, you have been outspoken about the importance of renewable energy, climate resilience, adaptation and mitigation, as well as emerging technology. How do you see Africa embracing these issues you have been passionate about?
You know, Africa only contributes no more than 3% or 4% of greenhouse gas emissions. But now we have to actually deal with the negative consequences of it. For example, Peter, you know, the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that just came out, and it was scary. It basically says that Africa will get drier, much hotter. It will make some parts of Africa probably almost not livable. I think we have to very quickly respond to that. Part of responding to that is we set up, that's when I say we, that's the African Development Bank, and the Global Center for Adaptation. This is chaired by the former United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. We set up what's called the African Adaptation Acceleration Program. This is to mobilize an additional, leverage an additional $25 billion towards adaptation in Africa. And not just the money, just think of what it's going to do. First is we want to reach 30 million farmers and pastoralists in Africa with digital climate advisory services that will allow them to be able to have good information and therefore be able to adapt to climate change. From other parts of the bank's work, which is on agriculture, right, we are providing today access to farmers with drought-tolerant maize varieties all across Eastern Africa and Southern Africa. We are providing them access to heat-tolerant wheat varieties. Today, you go to Sudan. They are growing wheat in the Gezira scheme, which is actually a very dry area, and you have a temperate crop being grown over there to help those farmers to be able to adapt to climate change.
Dr. Adesina, before we go, where do you see the bank's relationship with the rest of Africa's infrastructural development and the creation of jobs, particularly for the youth?
the two parts of it, you know, is the infrastructure part and then the youth part. Infrastructure will continue to be the big theme. So the opportunities for investment in infrastructure are massive, and they will create significant amount of jobs. But coming to the issue of jobs, the young people that you talked about, we've got to create new financial ecosystems around Africa's youth. We've got 485 million of them, right, below the age of 35. That means that these are the people that are going to create the big jobs today, that are going to become the Zuckerbergs of tomorrow, the Bezos of tomorrow in Africa, the Gates of tomorrow in Africa, right? But we must invest in them today. They need access to finance. And so the African Development Bank is currently working with African countries to, you know, design what we call youth entrepreneurship investment banks. These will be new types of financial institutions dedicated exclusively to the businesses and enterprises of young people.
Dr. Akinwumi Adesina is the president of the African Development Bank. He spoke with me from here in Washington. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports nearly 500,000 people affected by flooding in South Sudan are facing a humanitarian crisis, including acute food shortages. Large parts of Sudan are also hit by floods, which are ravaging whole communities. OCHA is appealing for support from the international community to provide emergency aid. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The rains came early this year, beginning in South Sudan in late April instead of June. The buildup of massive amounts of rainwater has caused the Nile and Lowell rivers and Sud marshlands to overflow and flood large swathes of territory. Jonglei, Unity, Northern Bahr el-Ghazal, and Upper Nile are the worst affected states. The United Nations says nearly 500,000 people are suffering because of the floods. Jens Lajerke, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs spokesman, says aid agencies are doing their best to provide emergency relief.
Access is a major challenge, though, with most of the flood-affected areas inaccessible by road, and the transport of aid by air is very costly. Some of the flood-affected counties are also affected by ongoing violence, which creates significant challenges for the people affected and the humanitarians who try to respond to their needs.
Lajerke says aid agencies have delivered food, water purification tablets, plastic sheeting for temporary shelter, mosquito nets, and medical and other supplies, but resources are limited and must be replenished. Lack of money is hampering the operation, he says, with only 61% of this year's UN $1.7 billion South Sudan appeal met. He says a similar funding problem in Sudan is preventing emergency aid from being delivered to more than 314,000 flood victims. He says heavy rains have been wreaking havoc in 14 of Sudan's 18 states since July.
Flooding has destroyed or damaged more than 62,000 houses and displaced over 100,000 people. Bridges have collapsed and farmland has been inundated. Some 183,000 people have been reached with various kinds of assistance. However, relief stocks also here in Sudan urgently need to be replenished to maintain the response.
Lajerke says hundreds of thousands of Sudanese will be deprived of essential supplies and services for the rest of this year without more outside support, and that the UN's $1.9 billion Sudan appeal is only 29% funded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Malawi has deployed soldiers to distribute fuel at gas stations after a strike by fuel tank drivers this week led to shortages. The drivers are pressuring the government for a minimum wage increase and to ensure local drivers get contracts they say are dominated by foreign transporters. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
Tanker drivers started the strike Monday in the country's major cities of Lilongwe, Blantyre and Nzuzu. On Wednesday, they blocked the road in the capital Lilongwe, resulting in some arrests. Government spokesperson Gospel Kazaku told a press conference Thursday that the strike is surprising, considering that the government officials already addressed all the demands the drivers raised during a similar strike in November of last year. He said among them was that the government should review the minimum salary for them, which was at about $60 per month.
The government had to go all out listening to their problems. Government made a directive, and this was made into law, that there shouldn't be any international truck driver who should be paid less than 140,000 baht.
That figure is equivalent to about $170 per month, but drivers have yet to receive the increased salaries. This, they say, is largely because their employers are going through financial difficulties due to lack of business from the government. They said the strike is also aimed at pushing the government to award their employers local fuel supply contracts they say are dominated by foreign transporters. This forced truck owners to join the strike on Wednesday. Kazako, also Minister of Information, said he believes the strike is a ploy to sabotage government operations. George Kaki, president of the Employers Conservative Association of Malawi, says the strike is baseless.
If they wanted to have industrial action, that industrial action should have been against their employers, not against government, because government is not a party to the employment contract. This is where, one, they are getting it wrong, and it is unfortunately an unlawful strike.
The strike led to panic buying this week at the few Malawian gas stations which had fuel. Malawi Energy Regulatory Authority says the country has enough gas to last for a month, but the problem is the failure to supply the pump stations because of the strike. To address the problem, Kazako said the government has deployed the military to help distribute fuel. Starting Thursday night, soldiers began escorting fuel tankers to pump stations and in some cases are driving the tankers themselves. In a statement Thursday, Acting Public Information Officer for the Malawi Defense Force, Major Emmanuel Kevin Mulelemba, said the move is in line with its constitutional role in assisting civilian authorities maintain essential services in times of emergency. Meanwhile, the striking drivers maintain they will not resume work until their demands are met. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's start in London, where Ethiopia's Cisse Lema won the men's London Marathon. He landed the biggest win of his career, coming in 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 0.1 seconds. Kenya's Vincent Kipchumba and Ethiopia's Mosnet Geremew were second and third, respectively. In the women's race, Jocelyn Jepkosgei upset Kenyan compatriot and world record holder Bridget Kosgei to claim her first London Marathon title. Jepkosgei, who won the 2019 New York Marathon, won in 2 hours, 17 minutes and 43 seconds, while Kosgei dropped back and finished fourth. Dejitu Asmerow of Ethiopia was second, with compatriot Ashete Bekere coming in third. Meanwhile, the organizers of the Nagoya Women's Marathon have announced they will increase the prize money for the 2022 race, scheduled for March 13, 2022, to $250,000. The increase will make the World Athletics Elite Platinum Label Road Race the highest prize-paying marathon in the world. The Nagoya Women's Marathon is the largest women's marathon, one of the world's top-level races, and the only women's race with the World Athletics Platinum Label. In football, the African qualifying competition for the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022 resumes with matches taking place across the continent between October 6th and October 9th. Meanwhile, the Twiga Stars of Tanzania are through to the semi-final stage of the COSAFA Women's Championship 2021. A 2-0 win against Botswana in a Group B match on Saturday was their second straight win. In their opening match, Tanzania beat Zimbabwe 3-0 and will now battle South Sudan in their last Group B match on Monday. The group stage of the COSAFA Women's Championship has attracted 12 teams and will end on October 5th before the semifinals are played on October 7th and the final 2 days later. And in rugby, South Africa beat New Zealand 31-29 in a thrilling final match of the Rugby Championship. Damian Dialende and Makazole Mapimpi were the scorers at the Springboks. Earlier, Australia beat Argentina 32-17 to finish second behind the All Blacks, who secured the title last weekend, and it was their fourth successive win of the competition. The All Blacks secured the title with victory over South Africa last weekend, but the world champions will now move back above their rivals to top the world rankings. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The general debate in the United Nations continued last week. The African representatives continued to express their views on a whole array of domestic, regional, and global problems. By and large, they focused, as was demonstrated last week, on three main themes. The impact of the vaccine problem, which is the COVID-19 problem, the impact of climate change, and the prospect of the conference in Glasgow in November, and also the continuing threat to democracy globally. Apart from these statements, however, there were specific comments made by representatives which warrant wider African attention. The Moroccan representative spoke about the deteriorating relations between Morocco and Algeria, in effect blaming Algeria for the deteriorating situation. Morocco was also very optimistic about its foreign relations successes. In fact, the representative said that it is almost a fait accompli that Morocco's sovereignty in Western Sahara has now been accepted, perhaps drawing attention to the decision of former President of the United States, Trump, recognizing Morocco's sovereignty in that problem. Then Morocco also proposed that a conference will be held in Africa about peacekeeping in the African continent, and that this conference will be jointly held by France and Morocco. The reason being, he said, that almost all peacekeeping operations in the African continent are in Francophone countries. However, he may also be referring to the fact that for the last 25 years, French nationals have been head of the peacekeeping department in the UN Secretariat. Another issue which was discussed in the sideline of the General Assembly is one which was raised by the president of Congo when he surprisingly announced that he, as the head of a committee on Libya, has been following closely developments in Libya. Surprise in the sense because African representatives in this conference have not been so visible. He, however, expressed some confidence that the elections scheduled for 24th December in Libya would prove successful. However, this optimism was not shared by the veteran foreign minister of Russia, Mr. Lavrov. Mr. Lavrov held a press conference at UN headquarters last week, and he threw cold water. He was asked whether Russia will engage in the withdrawal of troops, a condition which has been set by many European powers, mainly calling for the withdrawal of Russian and Turkish troops. Mr. Lavrov said that the issue of withdrawal of foreign troops is not a matter only for the recognized governments in Libya. He noted there is yet another government in the east of Libya which should be recognized and that they have something to say about the withdrawal of troops. These exchanges may indicate that there are still problems to be settled in the Libyan negotiations before one can be as optimistic as the president of Congo was. Yet another problem rose up in this press conference, which Africans should be aware of. He was asked whether there were foreign Russian troops. He denied it, but agreed that there might be a Russian private military company operating in Libya, the so-called Wagner Group. This is the same problem which seems to have been worrying European powers in Mali. And the French government has made references to this in the past. As is known, one cannot be so certain whether elections will be held in Mali next year as been hoped. The reason being that the French government plans to withdraw its forces. The European powers who have been assisting the French, and even though there are UN forces in Mali, there is a good feeling that the Wagner Group is also in operations in Libya, and Europeans are worried about these Russian footprints in West Africa. Also, they have been concerned that the Wagner private military force from Russia is also being engaged in the Central African Republic. So these are issues which Africans should be aware of. Another matter which came up was the statement by the Deputy Prime Minister of Ethiopia. He vigorously criticized the Tigrayan forces in Ethiopia as the cause of the problem now going on in the country. He also made veiled threats that Ethiopia could not tolerate interference in the internal affairs of his country, mainly because there has been a deteriorating relationship between the Western powers and Ethiopia on the Tigrayan issue, particularly because of statements which have been made by a number of Western officials in terms of the delivery of humanitarian assistance. And the most recent concern is the Ethiopian government decision to expel 7 United Nations international civil servants on the grounds that they are persona non grata. This now has engaged the Secretary General of the United Nations, who has objected to this action by the Ethiopian government. He has talked with the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, and it doesn't seem to have been resolved because the 72 hours given to these staff members will expire today, Sunday. Attention also should be paid on this issue. One tantalizing matter also arose in the statement of the Kenyan representative. And there it was noted that President Kenyatta would preside over Security Council meetings in the month of October because Ethiopia, a few days ago, became the president of the Security Council. Hopefully, when President Kenyatta arrives in the Security Council for the special session, he may make comments not only about what he said he was going to do about how the UN could tackle major global problems, but to also give clearance what is the African role going to be in the face of these myriad problems which we have now discussed? It is time that Africa takes its position, not as bystanders, but as a continent, but put forward strongly its own vision of how the African continent could be called peace in peace, and not allow the continent to become the next major spot of conflict between the great powers. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Kutibu no pone milele milele tema milele umenibamba 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 Pika chakula kizuri nile nawe. Ninajua kufua nguo penzi wewe. Ni jukumu langu kuzifua penzi wewe. Baby, mapenzi kumbe usinizungurushe mwishoni nimwage. Hofu yangu wewe usijiturubuka mimi nitange tange. Baby oh baby oh, mwenzako najiponea wana na 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 mapenzi haya.
C'est dans ma nature, je te jure, bébé. C'est dans ma nature.
That was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you can't use your hand to force the sun to set. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.